brought to you by FlowSpark Media.
Once you create a group, you actually then create outgroups, and we need to stop doing that outgroup part of it and just create bigger and bigger groups so that we can be more connected, so we can do more amazing things, because we are capable of incredible things.
Welcome to another episode of the Science Centric Podcast. If you're new to this show, this is where we have thought-provoking conversations at the crossroads of science, society, and the natural world. And who am I? I am your host, Eric Olson, filmmaker, journalist, and all-around curious creative with a passion for science and nature. So if there's one thing you can't deny about the era we live in, it's that we're more connected than we've ever been before. This podcast is a great example. I can reach out to just about anyone, anywhere on the planet, record an interesting conversation, and then beam it straight to YouTube or the mobile device in your pocket. Now, this might seem kind of basic to our younger audience, but for someone who grew up in a time before the internet, it feels like we're living out the science fiction dreams of the 1980s, just with less cringy clothes and haircuts. Anyways, being more connected than ever before, we seem to feel more and more isolated. Depression and anxiety have been steadily rising, particularly amongst young people, who are the most avid consumers of digital technology. And of course, the COVID pandemic accelerated this trend, normalizing online interactions over face-to-face meetings. My guest in this episode, cognitive neuroscientist Mark Williams, is on a mission to correct some of the problems caused by this rapid adoption of technology. After working in academia for nearly 20 years, including a stint at MIT, he now runs programs for both kids and adults to help them understand and better manage their interactions with technology. He also looks at these issues in his latest book, The Connected Species: How the Evolution of the Human Brain Can Save the World. The book also talks about how we evolved to be such socially connected creatures in the first place, and how our need to connect and form groups is at the root of some other chronic problems society faces, such as racism and sexism. But before we chat with Mark about his book, just a quick reminder to rate this episode and leave us a review on whichever platform you're listening on. Your reviews and comments help this show get noticed. Thanks for helping our podcast to grow and for making the world a little more science-centric. So the book's called The Connected Species, which of course refers to humanity. I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about what we know about how humans started, where humanity started, and what, if we were to take a look at humans objectively as a species, like what would be our natural environment that we would be most at home in?
Yeah, it's a great question, because if you actually look at us as a species, we're actually not that good. I mean, we're not the fastest species that's out there, and we're not the strongest species that's out there, and we don't have the largest brain of any species, and we don't actually adapt very well to different environments. So we're pretty useless when it comes to just our raw ability. But the thing that really stands us apart from any other animal is our ability to connect, and to connect across groups, not only within groups. So if you look at like honeybees, they have amazing communities where they all connect within the community, but one hive won't turn around to another hive and say, we have extra honey this month, so you can have some, and then you owe us later on. Whereas we do that, right? We connect all across the world. Everybody's connected. I have this, as we were talking about, this amazing technology that allows us to talk across continents, but all of the stuff that went into actually building the laptops that we're actually working off come from all over the world. I mean, you know, it's, some of the metals are pulled out of the earth in Africa, and all, you know, I mean, it's astounding to think about it. Plus, across generations, which again, animals don't do that. They don't actually teach across multiple generations. A parent may teach its siblings how to do certain things, but we don't have that knowledge been passed on in other species, but we do in ours. And that's what makes us amazing, right? That makes us so, so amazing, which is why I called us the connected species, because that's really what has brought us to the point we are now. And I think it's really sad that we're being pulled apart at the moment because of that as well, because we have this real drive to connect to people. Because of that, mm-hmm. once you create a group, you actually then create out-groups. And we need to stop doing that out-group part of it and just create bigger and bigger groups so that we can be more connected, so we can do more amazing things, because we are capable of incredible things, but we're also capable of incredibly awful things as well.
I've heard that there's a number of people that we can sort of keep track of in our mind, and I forget the name of it, but it's famous because companies started implementing this. They say, well, we're only going to have 200 people in one building, and that's the magic number, 200 people. Is that sort of our limit in terms of how many people we can feel connected to at any particular time? And does that connect with how we evolved?
It's an interesting idea. I'm not a huge fan of it, because we don't have just one group, and that idea seems to suggest that we have one group that we have all the connections with, and we have, you know, if you say it's 100 or you say it's 1,000, then there's 1,000 in that group and that's it. But we have many, many different groups that we're associated with, and within those you're going to have thousands of people within each of them, or hundreds, or maybe just 10. And so that idea doesn't really gel with me, because, you know, for example, I'm a member of Surf Lifesaving here in Australia. And so as a member of that, I could run into someone in Perth, you know, the other side of the country, who's a member of Surf Life Savings, and we'd be, well, you know, talking the same language and connect to each other really easily. But then I'm also, you know, a huge fan of the Cats, which is a football team here in Australia. And anyone who's a member of the Cats, I'm going to associate with, I'm going to be happy to be part of their group. But then I have the work colleagues that I work with, and then I have, you know, book clubs that I'm a member of, and I'm a surfer, so, you know, there's all these surfing people that I associate with. There's so many different groups that we're a part of. The idea that we have just this limited number that we can actually be in one group doesn't actually work. And if you think about the way we evolved, we probably started off in very small family groups, and then those groups got larger, where several family groups probably moved around together. But because of genetics, you would have had to have moved one, either the males or the females, off into other groups, which would have joined other groups together through that process. Yeah. And so we have a very fluid group mentality. So I know there's been lots of writings about, you know, the tribe, and that we have these very strict groups and you can only have a certain number and all the rest of it. But that doesn't actually make sense from an evolutionary point of view, because our groups can actually expand and contract very easily, and they would need to, because we'd need to be associating with different groups. I mean, we'd need to be, you know, coming in contact with different groups, and that's the amazing thing about our species, that we're able to do that. So yeah, I don't like the idea of putting this number on it, because it doesn't actually work from a practical point of view, and from an evolutionary point of view. So I think it's not. I mean, there's lots of these things out there that are really nice to say. You know, if we only 1,000 of this, or only, you know, do 10,000 steps and you'll be healthy and all the rest of it. But it never really comes down to being that simple, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think they just lowered that to 6,000. By the way, or whoever they are. Yeah, whoever they are.
Whoever that happened.
So I'm remembering in the book you pointed to two really kind of important developments in human evolution. One was tool use, and then also you just mentioned the genetic needing to move people out of the tribe that were too closely related genetically, so that we could get some fresh DNA into the group. So, like, how could you unpack that a little bit, and how that relates to our evolution?
Yeah, tool use is really interesting, because if you think about tool use, to make tools actually takes a lot of time. And to make tools well takes even more time, because you've got to practice a lot. And so to actually do that, you need to give up other things. And you can imagine a point where people went, hey, you're really good at making tools. And we don't want to lose you, so we don't want you to go hunting with us, because you might get killed by a leopard or jaguar or whatever. So you stay here and make the tools, and get really good at it, and then you give us the tools so we can then go out and go hunting or go digging for stuff and all the rest of it. And so that would have been a really important step in our evolution, not the actual tool making, but rather the segregation of tasks, saying you do this and then we'll do this and we'll give you some of the food when we get it, because of course you need the food to survive. And that would have segregated that, which meant that we then segregated more and more and more, which is why we're now in a point where, you know, everybody does different things. But because that also relies on this faith, right? It relies on the fact that if I stay home and learn how to be really good at tool making and don't become very good at hunting, I'm losing one of my abilities. I'm losing this ability to hunt and actually to keep myself alive by getting food. And so I have to rely on you to actually give me food when you get food. And so that takes a lot of faith in each other, right? And that's where we are at the moment, right? If I turn around and go, okay, I'm going to become an engineer, I have to then rely on the fact that then the society is then going to pay me a decent wage and give me all the things that I need for me becoming an engineer or becoming an artist or becoming whatever it happens to be. And that it does require us all being, you know, the faith in that. And I think that's one area that we're really falling down at the moment, because, you know, we're coming to a point where a lot of people are doing jobs that they're not actually getting paid well for or not getting paid enough for. And that means that we're breaking down that actual system of, hey, if we all do our jobs properly and we all do them well, we're all going to be rewarded for that and we're all going to support each other for that. It's been broken down now a little bit, and I think that's really sad. And I think that's causing a lot of the tension in society at the moment. And we need to really think about that and think about the fact that everyone who is doing a job actually deserves to be paid at a rate that actually means that they're surviving well, really well, right? Rather than having a small percentage of people making all the money and everyone else suffering and struggling to actually do that.
Yeah, we value certain roles more than others for reasons that aren't entirely clear. Exactly. Really important ones, like teachers, right?
Exactly. Teachers, nurses. Even nurses, the people who clean up, right? I mean, that's an extremely important role, because things get dirty, we get infections, we get all the rest of it, right? We need to really value everybody in society, and I don't think we do enough of that and realize how important that is.
I mean, you view that sort of cohesiveness of humans as a function of specialization, though. Is that a fair sort of summary of what you're saying?
Yeah, which is really, and it's an interesting dichotomy, right? I'm arguing that by specializing, we became more connected.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas we all normally think about specialization as actually removing yourself from the gap. Whereas what I'm arguing is that by specializing, we're actually becoming more connected, because we have to rely on each other then more to do that. I think I talk about, you know, if Bill Gates, had to go out and find his own food and work the fields and all the rest of it, he would have never come up with, you know, the personal computer and so on, right? He would have never had time to do all those things. And so we need to give people time to do those things, but then we need to support them in doing that.
Right. I also question Bill Gates' ability to hunt. But maybe that's a function of specializing in tech. You're letting one skill set go for another one.
For another.
Okay, I'll stop making jokes at Bill Gates' expense.
That's fine with me.
Hey there, if you made it this far through the episode, you're probably enjoying this conversation and learning a few new things along the way. If so, I'd really appreciate your support so that we can bring you even more quality science and nature content to YouTube. Head on over to our Patreon page to find out how you can support us directly. We have 3 tiers you can join, and they start at only $1 a month. The link's in the description below. And thank you to our existing patrons for their support. Now on with the show. Okay, so if we're talking about human evolution, we're still talking about fairly small, homogeneous groups of people. And one thing you talked about in the book, which I thought was really interesting, is how our visual perception is so cued to faces, and how this hardwiring to recognize faces actually creates some problems in terms of who we view as part of our group and who we view as not part of our group. So could you talk a little bit about that? I found that really fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's a really fascinating area that I don't think has been written about. I mean, there's a huge amount of research on it, but there's not much out in the general population. I think we need to understand it better. But so we can recognize thousands and thousands of individuals, and we recognize individuals across long periods of time. So you can see someone that you haven't seen for 10, 15, 20 years time, and they may have lost their hair, you know, gone gray, put on weight, lost weight, all these different things, which actually changes the face quite a lot, as well as the wrinkles and all the other things, or Botox or whatever they happen to do for their face, get a nose job and so on. And we'll still recognize that individual. And I mean, it's quite amazing that we're able to do that. And we actually do that because we don't recognize individuals based on all the parts of the face. We don't do it like we normally do with other objects, but rather on the relationship of the different parts. So how far apart the eyes are and how far the nose is down close to the mouth and all those. It's a relationship. And it's the relationship relative to this template that we have. So we have this average face in our brain in an area called the fusiform face area. And that average face is the average of all the faces we've ever seen, and then we detect faces relative to that, how far apart the nose is and the eyes and everything relative to that average face. Now, that average face is based on all the faces that we've seen, and we detect, well, when we originally would have been moving around, we would have been in family groups, and so everybody we saw would have been a family group, and families, you can detect whether or not someone's from the same family or not because those ratios are actually closer together if they're from mm-hmm. the same family. And so we're able to detect if someone's from our group because they're closer together. Now, this has, of course, gone on to cause an issue because if those ratios are further apart, if the face that we see isn't close to our average, then that sets off a fight or flight response because that says this person isn't part of our group. This person is somebody else. And that is where we have an issue with race, for example, because the faces that we see most often are faces that are of our race, and that doesn't matter where you actually come from. There's a lot of evidence for that. But you mainly see people, of course, because when you're younger, you see people within your family, but also what's on TV and what you actually watch. And even now on Facebook and so on, the feeds you get are actually usually more than likely members of your race. And so we're always seeing people, or we're mainly seeing people of the same race. So if people from other races, they deviate much further apart from a normal. So we have this automatic response to that, that says this person isn't part of your group, so therefore you need to do something about it. And that sets off your fight or flight response. It also means that there's the other race effect, that we don't recognize people from other races as well because they're further away from that average that we have, that average template that we have. So therefore we have much more difficulty recognizing people from other races. And we also orient to people from other races much quicker because our brain is saying, hey, this is somebody who's not part of our group. So we need to orient to them to make sure that they're not going to do something. And that goes back to, you know, millions of years ago. It's not because we're racist today, but it goes back to this. But it is an automatic response. It speeds up our heart rate. It makes us breathe more shallowly. It pumps blood to our muscles and so on. So, and it dilates our pupils. And so if you meet someone who's from another race, this is going to happen automatically if you have a very narrow template. And they're going to know that because they're going to automatically detect that your muscles, your face is becoming flushed because blood's been pumped to your muscles.
Wow.
Yeah, your eyes are dilated, so they're going to automatically. But they're not going to realize that they're actually recognizing that. And so they're going to have the same response as you, which is a fight or flight response, which is going to make that more difficult. So we all need to recognize that that's actually happening when this happens. And of course, it's not something that's taught, I don't believe, in, you know, law enforcement and in army and so on. But it is why we have well, it's one of the components why we have difficulty often with one race against another, and this happens everywhere. And I'm not saying it's a big issue in the US. In fact, Japan is actually, according to the OECD, Japan's the most racist country in the world. So, you know, and that is because it's such a homogeneous country. Most people in Japan are Japanese, and all of their media is around Japanese faces and so on. So they have a much bigger response to this template than in other countries. But most people have that. And so what we've got to do is look at lots of different faces regularly, and you can actually widen that template, which is really interesting. We can actually train our template to be much wider so that it's not as likely to activate and cause this fight or flight response.
This fusiform face area?
Fusiform face area, yeah.
Yeah, it's an actual part of the brain that is like, that's making these calculations. I mean, how fast is that happening?
So it's all subconscious. So you're talking, it activates within 170 milliseconds. So it's sub-seconds. It's like really, really quick. And it's happening automatically. And we also know there's great research now showing that it'll do it on a group basis as well. So if you're in a room, it'll actually detect. So it'll orient you to the individuals who are from another race. So even without you knowing about it. So if there's 100 people there, and there's one person who's from a different race to you, you will orient straight to that person without even realizing that you're doing that. And it will detect them, and it will then process that individual's there, and it's something that you need to attend to. And then you need to attend to it so that your more conscious areas of your brain can go, oh, hang on, it's somebody that I know or somebody that I don't have to worry about or whatever. But, of course, we don't do that because of the fact there's 100 people there and we don't have the time to do that. And we have to realize that our brains... evolved in an environment where there was very few people. And we've only had lots of people in our environment in the last 100 or so years, or 200 years, 300 years, depending on where you're actually from. But vast majority of people, A, only started reading and writing in the last generation or two. But two, they only started living in large groups in the last generation or two. So our brains haven't evolved to actually cope with this environment where there's lots of people around. And so we need to be aware of the fact that we're still using a primitive brain, right? Our brain is still the same as it was 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago when we're all living in small tribes.
So if I'm, you know, I live in New York City, so I'm walking down the street, and like where I live is incredibly diverse. I mean, you have every ethnicity represented. I mean, is my brain just going crazy? Is that raising my heart rate and my, you know, stress level just being around and my brain trying to process all these different faces? Or by virtue of living here, is my average face starting to look different than my race? Is it starting to look, you know, more of an amalgam of or average of all these faces that I encounter all the time?
Yes, most likely it's probably becoming more wider than a normal, than your average, than an individual who lives in a more homogeneous society. So you would have a wider template, which is great. If you're actually attending to those people regularly and you're associating them with being part of your group. So you're a New Yorker, and these are all New Yorkers, so we're all part of the same group. But if you're walking around and thinking, these are part of my group, I don't actually want anything to do with them, then it won't incorporate it. You have to be incorporating them. These are good people who are part of my group, rather than I'm going to ignore them and I don't want them to be part of it, not really attending to them. So, yes, if you are incorporating them into your group, then, yes, they will become part of your template. So, therefore, it will adjust according to that, and which is quite amazing that we can do that. And it's been shown both with kids who read books with lots and lots of different faces from lots and lots of different races don't have this same race effect. And similarly, adults who do that for a period of time can decrease that effect as well. So we can retrain it, which is awesome.
How does confirmation bias play into this? Because if we're noticing people of different that are different from us or don't fit our average template, are we more likely to, you know, pick them out of a crowd doing something that we don't like, or how does that work?
Yes. Confirmation bias is really difficult to get over. And this is, of course, a whole other aspect to it, which is all the stereotypes that we have in our brains as well. So we have this automatic thing, which is unconscious, which we've been talking about. And then we have this more explicit thing, which is what we actually learn, what we see in the media, what we're told by our parents, what we're told by our friends, which is our, there's the stereotypes that we have. And then we're constantly wanting to confirm that because we are constantly wanting our world to be the way we expect it to be, right? We don't want to be shocked that the world's different to the way we expect it. So if we live in a world which is, you know, where different races behave in certain ways, then we're going to confirm that constantly, and we're going to notice when that happens and they behave in that way, and we're not going to notice when they don't behave in that way. And this is, of course, why, and I know a lot of people call it woke and all the rest of it, but this is why there's been a big push for the media to start using different races as the hero in their stories, or as the main characters in their stories, and so on. Not only for those races that haven't seen that before and therefore need those people to look up to, if you like, or to have, you know, heroes that they can actually go, hey, they're really cool, but also so that those people from the other races can go, oh, those people are also good. Those people can also do these other things and start challenging some of those stereotypes. But it is really hard because we do have this confirmation bias that is constantly going on, which is to always ignore what doesn't fit with what we want and to actually go. And I don't think most people realize that either. I don't think people realize that, you know, the perception that we have of the world and what we actually see and hear and feel is actually generated by our brains. It's not actually what's out there. And we're actually got, you know, this illusion going on all the time, which is based on making our lives as simple and as regimented and as is expected as possible, so that we feel comfortable in our own skin.
We're seeing things through a filter. I mean, that's one of the reasons, like, I really try to read widely, even things that I don't that I disagree with. I follow people on social media I don't agree with. I try to get a lot of different perspectives. I usually end up agreeing more with one person than another, but at least I try to, like, not filter. And it seems like social media exacerbates this as well with this confirmation bias thing, because it's, you know, algorithmically driven to show us things it thinks we'll interact with and comment on. And
I don't understand why governments allow the algorithms to still continue to go on in these social media, because it is extremely bad for all of us to be constantly fed stuff that confirms our biases, right? And it just makes us more and more driven in one way. And that's all they're doing, is they're working out what people actually, what their confirmation bias is, and then driving them further and further and further down that road, so that they'll keep looking at it, because it does keep confirming what they think is what the world is like. And it keeps taking them down these rabbit holes. And we know there's great research showing if you get rid of the algorithms, people actually come together, right? People are more likely to agree with each other. There's great study with Republicans and Democrats, and they showed that if you get rid of the algorithms in the background, then Republicans and Democrats are more likely to agree with each other. And if you have those algorithms running in the background, then they become more separated from each other. So these are really driving us apart, and they're causing a lot of the political issues that we're having all over the world, because we're becoming more separated and we're just being fed this information, which is, yeah, is confirming our biases. And we need, I mean, governments need to do something about it. I don't understand, back in the, when we first had TV, subliminal advertising started. So the advertisers started using subliminal advertising where they'd flash up something really quickly and then get rid of it. And governments within a couple of months turned around and said, hang on, this is actually influencing people's behavior without them being aware of it. So we need to ban it. And they banned it very, very quickly. Whereas what they're doing now is far, far worse and far, far more manipulative than that. And yet governments won't do anything about it. It just makes sense. I mean, I understand. It's all money. It's extremely wealthy people in this game at the moment who are controlling that. But we do need to ban it. It needs to be stopped.
Yeah, I mean, if there's one theme on this podcast, it's that social media is evil and we all need to disengage from it.
And it's really sad because it could be done really well if it was done in a way which was actually to connect us, and if it was done in a way which was about informing people about the truth. I think it could be done extremely well. But it's not. It's done because there's a couple of big companies that want to make a lot of money, and that's what they're doing. They're making huge amounts of money. I saw Facebook or whatever they call themselves now, just made huge profits again, bounced back very quickly from the Meta debacle. But we need to realize that, unfortunately, not all companies, but most companies are about making a lot of money, and they'll do whatever they can to do that. And we need to realize that, and we need to somehow take that away from that ability away from them, because it's manipulating people in a really negative way.
I just recently there's a lot of colleagues of mine, former colleagues, have been laid off that work in journalism, and I was just thinking, talking about the money aspect of that, we're getting a little bit off the science, but those companies have sucked a lot of money out of journalism. They've kind of ruined the publishing aspect of journalism. And so journalists, their role is to kind of bridge, in a lot of ways, the divide between people and find out what the facts are. And, a kind of classic journalism, at least in the United States and Western world, it kind of does connect people in a way. And now that's all getting pulled out and put into these social companies, which is kind of sad,
I don't know how we can have a really democratic country without having good journalists. We need good investigative journalism to have a truly democratic country, because we need people questioning what's actually happening, and we need access to the information, and you need good journalists to do that. And unfortunately, all of the journalists, they're either becoming freelance, which makes it really difficult for them to spend long periods of time investigating whatever it happens to be, and being able to take the risk of going down rabbit holes and everything, which is when we find out the important stuff, right? When they actually do that. And without that, we can't have democracy, right? So we need to invest back in journalism. The two big things, right? Science and journalism, and good journalism, have both been decimated recently, which means that we can't have great democracies that we used to have.
Or even just agreeing on what facts are. That's another, just verification of facts and saying, hey, these are the facts. Let's respond to them. But it seems a lot of the time what's happening now is it's just let's put out the opinion before we know the facts are even correct. So anyways, aside from the confirmation bias thing, I think there's that corrosive aspect of it as well. It's basically defunding our fact checkers, which is not good.
Yeah, and I think there also the 24-hour news feed now.
Oh yeah,
means that nothing's investigated, and it's just constantly update, which means that it's not checked before it actually goes out, and so many problems with that. But I don't know how we get around that.
We shouldn't blame it completely on social media that started with, the 24-hour cable news cycle as well.
Definitely.
So bringing it back to this question of race, sort of race recognition, I guess you would call it, from this fusiform face area. One thing I do kind of, and you can push back on this, but one thing I do find encouraging about that is it just says in a way that at least, I don't want to say racism because there's various components of it, but at least recognition of race is a human condition. Like you brought up Japan. If you're in Japan, you might experience some kind of racism or stereotyping because you're white, or some other race. I think sometimes it gets put specifically on European people of European ancestry, but it seems like this could happen anywhere in terms of race recognition and confirmation bias. And do you agree with that?
If racism, it does Well, I mean, probably because we both come from Western countries, we hear about it more in the Western countries than here in Australia. We hear about it a lot. But it's actually not, well, I'm not going to say it's not as bad because it's always bad, right? Racism is bad, and I'm not going to say it's not bad. But you talk about like the Uyghurs in China. I mean, that is awful what's happened there. You talk about, the awful things with Thailand in Cambodia, or you think about what happened in Rwanda and all these things, right? It happens all over the world, and it's really sad, and it happens. We have races because we have groups, right? Races originally evolved because we had groups. So there's certain groups move to different areas, and therefore they evolve slightly different skin tones and so on because of they were living in different areas with different conditions. And so that actually happened because of the groups that we formed. Now that we're trying to mix back together, it's causing actually problems from that point of view, which is something I think we can solve if we all work together to do that. And there's multiple aspects to it. One of them is the face template. Another is confirmation bias and the stereotypes that we actually need to work on. Another one, of course, is just the fact that we're biased towards our own races through the fact that we grow up in those races, right? That society's set up where we're more likely to associate with people from our same races. And we probably need more melting pots like New York, where everybody's mixing with each other. But you need to mix. You can always, I know in New York there's areas where, there's a lot more of certain races. And that's an interesting thing as well, that we get those pots within more multicultural areas, you get pods within it that stick together.
Yeah, I think that's changing. It's partially a function of immigration and people coming and not speaking the language, and so they tend to gravitate together. And then over generations, they kind of disperse out of that. But I think that's changed. I think public education and I think those ethnic enclaves, as we call them, are shrinking to some degree in New York. There used to be a lot more of them, and they're still there, but they're I could probably name them. There's probably three of them that I could name, at least in Brooklyn where I live. So as an individual, I mean, and let's say you don't live in New York City, like what can you do to kind of expand that template? And I was just thinking that as a child of the 1980s, we grew up with like the Cosby Show, mm-hmm. which was great. I mean, it showed, but aside from Bill Cosby's other things happening, but the image, the representation was fantastic. It was a family of a doctor and a lawyer and their kids, and they lived, I think they were supposed to live in Brooklyn actually, and they were successful and they were a great family. And then but on the flip side, we also had Cops, the show Cops, where you're showing like people in their worst moment of their lives, and I feel like it disproportionately focused on Black people. So, we have a lot more media options now, fortunately. But like, is that a route into expanding that face template, or do you really need to have like face to face interactions with people?
So it doesn't need to be face to face. So some of the research with kids has done it with books. So they've just had the kids reading different books with a whole range of faces in those books, and a whole bunch of different characters in the books. It's important to make sure that the characters from other races have leading roles or have positive roles in those books, and that's. Of course, we did have this shift in the 80s and 90s and all early 2000s where they were introducing more races into a lot of the media and stuff, but they would take secondary roles rather than being the primary role, or they would be the evil person in it. So they'd say, we've got a normal mix of people, but then the roles that they were given. So we've got to have it so, and I think you pointed to that, right, that the Cops, that they the criminals on the cops is always the black person or the, you know, the person who, yeah, it's from the other race, which is really, really sad. And we need to flip that and have it the other way around. But we can do it through the media. We could do it through the media if we wanted to. But I mean, sadly, it doesn't really happen. I mean, how many Marvel superheroes are there that are Asian or black? One Asian one, for example. I mean, Star Wars, when Star Wars had an individual who was black in a more leading role, unfortunately, he was a stormtrooper who, you know, had converted and had, you know, issues and all this, rather than being an actual, whereas they're still, you know, all the Jedi, most of the Jedi's are white or aliens, right? And so we need to flip that. We need to change that so that everybody, and I know it sounds woke, but it's a fact that, you know, it's true. It's right. It's not. It's one term like, can't stand.
I'm laughing because I'm just thinking, well, some people must have a face template of what a stormtrooper looks like, and I think that's kind of funny in a way. Apparently they're white, and
probably a Wookiee as well. I mean, it's pretty interesting because we've found that even cows have face templates, so
Which
is pretty cool. Yeah, cows recognize each other based on their faces, and they have a similar face template to ours.
Yeah. It's a really deep kind of ingrained thing. It's not something that we can just dismiss.
Seriously old. Yeah, very, very old. It's something that is in every mammal that's been tested so far has had, as far as I'm aware, has had a face template. I don't think the moles, so moles don't, but they don't have normal vision, so it's completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. But if you think about it, it makes sense because we recognize all animals, right? You actually approach another animal face forward. So it makes a lot of sense that it's actually the faces that are what is used to actually identify each other, because you're always directing your face towards it because that's how we see each other. And so you think of a wolf or anything approaching each other, they're going to be face forward. You don't very rarely back up to another animal when you're trying to work out with their friend or foe. So it makes sense that that's what we've used ever since the dawn of time to recognize each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm imagining that's very adaptive because you need to recognize that instantly. Do I need to run, or am I walking, or am I walking towards this individual?
Am I safe, or am I, all animals use their faces to communicate, right? And the growls and the snarls and the showing the teeth and all the rest of it in ways of saying, no, go away, or they'll have, sympathetic stuff, which is why we love dogs, right? Because they have those goofy eyes at us and all the rest of it when they want us to pat them, and they'll show their teeth when they don't want us to pat them, and yeah, we can understand that from our own perspective, and so we've all species, use that. Mammal species, all animal species seem to use that as their way of communicating with each other. It's a primary one.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy books about science and nature as much as I do? They bring a lot of information together and help you learn about science and the natural world on a much deeper level than you just get from consuming news. Well, we've curated a great list of books over at our website on a page we call the Reading Room. It also features the books of all the authors that we've had on this podcast. Any purchases made through the Reading Room help support our channel with no added cost to you. Check it out at sciencecentric.com or look for a link in the description below. Since we've already dunked on technology here, and we might as well continue that thread. Let's talk about some of the deficits that we're experiencing in terms of human connection. So, we're even though maybe we're evolved to deal with a tribe of 1,000 individuals, we're now 8 billion people, and we're more connected. But you read news reports, there's a loneliness epidemic, people are anxious. It seems like the more we're connecting online, the smaller the world's becoming. We're also becoming more neurotic and depressed. So what is it about live interaction that's different about, you know, than talking to somebody as we're talking right now?
As we're talking now. Yeah.
Digital means.
So, yeah, with these multiple things, right? From an evolutionary point of view, when we actually met someone, we would first, you know, identify whether or not friend or foe by the face, which is really, really important. But there's multiple aspects to that. It's not just the face, but also eye gaze. So eye gaze is really, really important for us, which we don't get. You and I have the eye gaze now because it's just you and I talking to each other. But if you have more than two people on any one of these chat groups, you'll have multiple faces all looking at you at the same time. Now, if you imagine if you're in down at the park or something, or you're at a pub and five people come up to you and all stood in front of you, just staring directly at you, how you would feel. You would feel very confronted by that. And so our brain automatically, when we have that, when we have multiple faces all looking at us and directly at us, becomes confronted by that. And there's this automatic process which says, hey, this is not normal. This is odd, which is why most people don't like doing meetings and all those sorts of things on those platforms. And most people will turn off their video cameras or they'll look away and do other things because it's really confronting to do that. But also when we normally would actually meet up with someone, we actually touch them. So appropriately touch them. And all societies have some way of appropriately touching each other when we actually greet. So in Stoic societies like here and in the US, we'd shake hands with each other. Even the Inuits, they actually rub noses because it's only part of their skin that's actually showing. And the reason we do that is we have sea fibers on our skin, and the sea fibers are actually just there for touch. And that's the only reason we have these sea fibers. And they activate an area of our brain which releases oxytocin. And oxytocin is, they call it the love hormone, right? It's actually a neurotransmitter that makes us more connected to the other person. It makes us more relaxed. And it makes us feel as though this person is someone we actually like. And so we get that as well, which we don't get when we're actually on the screen. And then we also got the body language. So I can only see you from the shoulders up. Or if you're on Instagram or any of those things, you just see, you know, part of the person or they're not moving, right? But we have a mirror neuron system, and the mirror neuron system actually mimics what the other person is doing in our brain, so we actually understand what they're doing. So, yeah, it was originally done with monkeys where they'd reach out and pick up a peanut, and then a monkey watching that monkey reach out and pick up a peanut, the area of their brain to enable them to reach out and pick up a peanut would activate their motor area, and also their muscles activate to a sub-level, so they don't actually move, but they activate a little bit, which is really important for us as to connect with each other. So you've probably seen, I do a lot of presentations with teenagers. I do a lot of stuff in schools with students. And it's amazing, you look at the group and you can tell which are the groups that actually hang out together because they'll all be sitting in the same way. And again, that's because of that mirror neuron system it activates with the people that we're actually connected with, and we'll actually move into the same position without even knowing it because of this mirror neuron system. So we'll actually mimic each other in our body language so that we actually say, hey, we're related to each other. We're in the same group. And that's why you'll see teenagers hanging out together or sitting in the same way or walking in the same way and so on, because they're mimicking each other through this mirror neuron system. And we don't get that when we're online as well because we don't see the whole body and we can't do that. And then there's a whole bunch of other, there's pheromones, so we're not getting the pheromones. So again, doing the touching, either shaking hands or, you know, rubbing noses if you're into that or whatever it happens to be, when you actually greet someone, actually activates not only that the C fibers and oxytocin, but also pheromones, because you're close enough to actually get those pheromones which go up your nose and into your brain. And that'll activate serotonin as well, which is also a neurotransmitter that'll relax us and make us feel better. So when we're online, we tend to just get dopamine. We just get this hit of dopamine, which is associated with, of course, addiction and all these things. And so you get this hit of dopamine, which is only short-lasting. And so in the book, I think I talk about the difference between eating fast food versus eating a home-cooked meal. And with online interaction or online communication, it's like you're having a fast food meal. You're getting the dopamine as you do when you eat fast food. And that's all you're getting. Whereas if you do it face-to-face, you get all these other neurotransmitters that we actually need and we've evolved to actually need. And they make us feel better. And they make us feel better for a much longer period of time. And it's fascinating. There's a great... The Harvard study, which recently came out, which has been going for 70, 75 years, I think it is, they've recently shown that just by sitting down and chatting to someone on a regular basis that you actually trust, face-to-face, it can actually increase your lifespan by 10 to 15 years, which is amazing, right? Just by sitting down and chatting to someone on a regular basis can do that. And also decreases the likelihood of you having other neurodegenerative diseases. So we need to be actually spending more time sitting down and chatting with people and not being online, because it's not the same as actually sitting down. As we talked about earlier, our brains have evolved to actually be sitting down with people, right? That's how we used to sit down. We used to spend, we used to actually spend most of our time sitting around campfires and actually chatting to people we love and learning from each other. And that's what we've actually got to be doing, because that's actually what brings us joy. And so we need to be doing that more often. And we all need to actually do that. But the problem with the brain is, well, it's not a problem, but the issue is that our brains are plastic. Our brains are constantly changing because of a thing called neuroplasticity. And we now know, whereas we used to think that we went through these different stages which Piaget came up with as we were growing up. And then once we got to about 25, our brains were set, and then we basically just deteriorated after that, which is a pretty sad way of thinking about life. We now know that's not true, that Piaget was wrong, and there aren't any of these critical stages, but rather our brains are constantly changing. So your brain's going to be different today than it was yesterday, and it'll be different again tomorrow, depending on what you do and what you don't do. But that's use it or lose it paradigm. So if you're using it in positive ways, it gets healthy, and if you're using it in negative ways, it gets less healthy. But it also means that it's adapting to your environment all the time. So if you're spending less time with people, then you're going to feel like spending less time with people, and you're not going to have the ability or the drive to actually spend time with people. So then you'll spend less time with people, which means that your brain's going to adapt to that and get used to that, which means you're going to spend less time with people. And you can see what happens. Yeah, it's just spirals,
a vicious
right?
cycle. Yeah.
And that's become even worse because of COVID, because everyone got scared of everyone, because we're all going to infect each other. Sorry, I said the word again. Since the epidemic.
I'm gonna bleep that out, Mark. Yeah, come on.
Since the C word.
And then it's going to sound like something worse.
Since the C word. When we're all told to stay away from each other, don't touch each other, which means we weren't getting the oxytocin that we need because we weren't touching each other. We couldn't see each other's faces because we had masks on, which was really, really bad. And actually, there was a hospital in the UK showed that patients weren't getting as well and were more likely to spend longer in hospital when all of their carers were wearing the face mask. So they actually put these clear face masks, which had a clear section here, so you could actually see the faces and you could actually see people smile at them and stuff. So it's really, really important that we actually do that social interaction. And being lonely actually kills us. Being lonely can cause psychosis. I mean, this is why we have... Why most countries now have banned solitary confinement from jails, right? Because it is really, really horrendous thing to do to someone, to actually put them in solitary confinement. And solitary confinement is just another version of being lonely, right? You actually don't have people around you. And we need to realize how bad it actually is for people. And we need people to be interacting with each other. And I find it crazy. I work with an organization which does digital detox with kids. Where they take them out on a camp for 2 weeks and they have psychologists working with them. These are kids who have spent 2-3 years in their bedrooms and haven't left their bedroom. And I find that ironic because when I was a kid, your parents sending you to the bedroom was the worst thing they could have done to you. I mean, it was like, and it was, number one punishment, right? You're grounded and you've got to stay in your bedroom for the next, 2 days. Whereas now... All these parents come to me saying, I can't get my kid to leave their bedroom. Just a huge flip in our... And we need to do something about that. Kids need to be out there interacting with each other. And it really frustrates me because schools are promoting this, right? Schools, both here and in the US, introducing more and more devices into schools. And it's not just the smartphones, it's also the laptops and all these other things into schools. And we know that learning on a screen is actually poorer for retention and for outcomes than learning on paper. Learning on a screen is more stressful than learning on paper. You remember less when you actually read things on a screen than when you learn on paper. Typing is actually worse for comprehension than actually writing with pen and paper. We need to be getting rid of the devices from the schools because it also makes it difficult for parents, right? Because the schools are saying kids have to have a laptop and they have to come to school with laptops and then they have to do all their homework on the laptops or on the computers. And then the parents are going, but hang on, we want the kids to be out, you know, doing stuff. And we need to realize that 21st century skills that kids are actually needing to develop are around communication, are around leadership, are around being able to work within a group, collaboration. These are the 21st century skills that kids are actually going to need. And I know a company, I was talking to a company just the other day, which has formed, and they're making huge amounts of money because they're actually teaching new grads how to talk on the phone. And all these companies are actually hiring this company to teach graduates how to talk on the phone because they don't know how to talk on the phone when they get a job, but they all of a sudden have to talk on the phone. I mean, there's the skills that we should be learning when we're teenagers or when we're kids, and we're not learning them. And now, good luck to this company because it's doing extremely well. But surely, schools need to be teaching kids what they actually need and what's actually needed for them, rather than be doing things which we know are detrimental to learning and detrimental to social communication, detrimental to these 21st century skills that they should actually be learning. And we need to really think about
that. Right. I mean, let me play devil's advocate for just one second. Yep. So if I would agree with most of that, but I think there's a counter argument that would be that, you know, what if their work is largely done, you know, in the cloud? What if their work is largely done virtually? I have an 11-year-old son that loves playing Minecraft, and I could see him, you know, meeting with people in that space. I mean, is there a case to be made for learning those skills?
The problem is we don't have to learn. As you said, you've got a 12-year-old son. Who does it for fun, right? So we don't need to be spending 6 hours a day in school learning something that they learn themselves. The reason that these technologies have taken off and become ubiquitous is that they're really, really simple and they're very intuitive. So you don't need to learn how to use. I haven't met a 7-year-old who can't use an iPad, right? They do it automatically and without even thinking about it. To be spending 13 years of school life learning how to use something that we learn anyway and we learn easily, right? My mother's got Alzheimer's and I taught her how to use a laptop in about an hour. She didn't need 13 years of schooling to learn how to use a laptop and be able to send emails and all the rest of it. And she has a neurodegenerative disease as well. So, we don't need to be doing that, right? What we need to be doing is teaching them skills that they're not learning at home and that they're not learning, right, in school. Schools, that's what school used to be about. It used to be teaching kids stuff that you wouldn't learn at home or that your parents couldn't teach you. But I think any parent can teach a kid how to turn on a laptop, or any kid can actually learn themselves how to use the cloud and so on because they are simple to use.
Yeah. No, that's a fair point. I've just heard that argument before, but
The other one I hear a lot also is that they now have access, right? That kids now have access to the world via the laptops, which they didn't have before. Which again is actually wrong, because being on a laptop, if you're searching on Google or you're searching on any of these platforms, there's algorithms running in the background that are actually biasing the information that you actually get. So it's actually been shown that we have all access to less information when we actually search things on the internet than we do if we actually go to a library and look it up. So because if you go to a library and look it up, you only get the information that you're actually looking for. Whereas if you do it on Google, you actually get biased towards the stuff that is actually what they think that you actually want to be reading. So we don't actually have access to the world. We have access to the information that the tech companies want to actually feed us.
So maybe just to wrap up, we talked a little bit about some of the negative effects of groups, but you know, this kind of in-group out-group mentality, but there are also positive effects of groups.
Absolutely.
At which we just talked about, like actually meeting with people in life, in real life, not chat rooms or, you know, social media. So, I guess I see a little bit of a contradiction in the fact that we sort of need groups, but by virtue of being in a group, we're excluding other people from that group. So I'll just give you an example from my life. So I have it is an online group, but it's particularly for people who produce science and natural history media. Well, I don't just let anyone into that group. I only let people into that group on LinkedIn and Facebook that are actually working in that field, because it's the goal of the group is to network, and we don't want a bunch of people coming in and trying to sell stuff. And, you know, like, who knows what would happen. But so, you know, I'm excluding people from that group. So, I mean, how do we balance that? And I'll throw in a bonus to that just to make it a little harder for you. I mean, one thing that you're advocating in the book is that we need to be more and more inclusive, which I would agree with. But we also have people with very different values. You know, there's different, I don't know if you're familiar with this concept of spiral dynamics, Claire Gray's work on values and you know, that we tend to, as we progress, and it sort of relates to Piaget's developmental stages, that we become more inclusive, that we can take more perspectives of different people, but not everybody's operating at those same levels, right? And we value different things. So, like, is it really feasible that we can really have groups that are so inclusive that they include everyone?
Yeah, two great questions. Tackle the first one first, because they're both big questions. So I think with the first one, which is what you, I think you were asking, is it okay to have exclusive groups? And when is that okay? Because we do need exclusive groups when we have specialization. And I talked about that earlier, that one of our big leaps forwards was starting to specialize and starting to have small groups which were specific to specific tasks. And I think what you need to think about is why is it that you're excluding somebody else? And if you're excluding somebody else with good reason, and I think your example was a great reason for that, right? It's we want this to be about this one topic. And anybody who's interested in that topic and has experience in that topic is actually welcome. So in a way, you're not excluding anybody who's actually interested in that topic. You're just excluding people who aren't joining it for the right reasons. So, and I think that's what we need to think about. Why are we excluding people? So rather than what's the criteria to be a member, but rather what's the criteria for not being a member? Why are we excluding it? And if that's for good reasons, if the exclusion is for good reasons, then that's fine. It's when it's not for good reasons that it's not fine, right? If it's because of the fact that we only want white people being part of this group, then that's not appropriate, right? Or, you know, we only want a particular group. For whatever. So I think that's when those groups become nefarious. And I think most of us have if we think about it, most of us realize when we're creating a group which isn't nice, right, which isn't appropriate, and we shouldn't be creating that group, and we should be dismantling that group. So and we do need the groups, because the groups are really important. The idea of different values, I don't think we actually do have different values. I think the fact that we are separated and don't talk to each other means that we don't have different values. I think we all have, you know, we all want to be safe. We all want to have food. We all want our families to be protected. Mm-hmm. We all want, yeah, mm-hmm. to have the opportunity and everybody else to have the opportunity to thrive. And so I think we all have those same values. And I've traveled a lot. And I've found that no matter where you travel, that people tend to always have those important values. I think there are, and I've been, I'm actually writing another book at the moment with a friend who's had an amazing life. And he, we've been talking about the fact that we've lost a lot of, we no longer teach kids appropriate behavior. And I think that's what we're losing. I don't think it's the values that we're losing. I think it's how to actually act in an appropriate way. I remember the other day I was on a tram with my teenage kids and the tram was empty. And so we were all sitting down and then the tram got full. One of the stops, a lot of people got on. It was on the weekend and there were several older people got on who, you know, had trouble walking. And so I automatically stood up and my kids also stood up so they could actually sit down. But as soon as we stood up, two teenagers sat down on our seats and with their headphones on and put their feet up on the other seat straight away. And so I said to them, hey, you know, they were fine. And then they actually then stood up and were very apologetic about what they'd done and let the older people sit down. And it was only because they'd never been taught that that's the appropriate way to act. And so I don't think we're losing. And I get the idea that we're different people have different values. But I don't really think I think we all have the same values. It's the behaviors that go behind those that we're losing. And I think we need to teach the next generation what is the right way to behave. And appropriate ways to behave. And you can talk about that in relation to, you know, if you talk about it like etiquette or something like that. But I think that's what we're losing now. And I don't think we're losing it because we're getting larger groups or we're getting different people involved. I think we're losing that because the parenting and how we parent now has changed. And so we're not teaching younger generations those the appropriate ways to behave and etiquette, if you want to use an old-fashioned term, right? What's actually appropriate and what's not appropriate. And I think that's what's missing. But I think we all have the same values.
I mean, I'm thinking in particular about... So are you familiar with Claire Graves' spiral dynamics stuff?
Yeah.
It's... Okay. Well, so just for people listening, it's the idea that there's, you know, people go through these stages. So there's the ones that I'm thinking of in particular are like, you know, mythical sort of values and really values and worldviews, the rational, and then, you know, kind of post-rational, post-modern. And it seems like that's where a lot of our political fallout is. And for example, you know, I'd say I'm probably somewhere in the rational, you know, sort of post-rational space as most people, you know, kind of more intellectual people are at this stage. But like, I find it sometimes hard to relate to people, for example, that are very religious because feels like it's from a different time, you know, and those values are a bit different. So that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking of. So they would form a group and I would form a group, but the whole reason the group would exist would be completely different because we have different values and different worldviews. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that does. And I understand. I appreciate that. And I think that those groups are fine. Our belief systems, I think it's fine to have different belief systems and therefore be part of different groups as long as you don't discriminate against the other group because of that, right? And I think that's where things break down. So as we talked about before, groups are really important and groups give us something to belong to. They give us someone, you know, a group of people that we trust, a group of people that we can rely on, and they're really good for our, you know, socialization and all these things. So that's fine. And of course, they teach us different behaviors and so on that I was just talking about. it's just as long as one group doesn't discriminate against another group. And that's where we've got into a problem, right? And that's where we're in a problem now, is that these groups have become are discriminated against other groups, and that's not fair and that's not appropriate.
Yeah.
And that's when I talk about the widening of the circle, is that it's fine to be in smaller groups, but then we also need to think about what's that we have this bigger group, which is humanity, which we all have the same values, I believe, which is that we want to be safe and we want to be protected and we want to live. And I have some kids who are looked after and have healthcare and all these things. And so therefore, any of the groups that we're a member of shouldn't be discriminating against those values.
Gotcha. Yeah. Those are common.
Common values.
Common human values, as it were.
Yeah, or should be anyway.
Yeah. Do you work for a science or technology focused organization and would like to create video content but don't know where to start? Well, my company, Flowspark Media, the publisher of this podcast, can help you. We are a one-stop shop that can provide content strategy, video production, and even social media management. Our previous clients include educational institutions, academic publishers, trade organizations, and aerospace companies. These are innovative, world-changing organizations who are leading humanity toward a brighter future. Learn more at flowspark.com or look for the link in the description below. There's an interesting story about this gentleman named, and I don't know if you're familiar with him, but his name's Daryl Davis. He's a black gentleman. And he, and actually this speaks to what you're talking about as well. And he took it upon himself to kind of infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan in the U.S. And are you familiar with this story?
No. At all?
Oh, okay. Yeah, interesting guy. And he actually has, I don't know exactly how he did it, but he sort of became friends with some of these people in the Ku Klux Klan. And just through their conversation was actually able to convert them to leave the Klan and realize that they were wrong. So I just think that's a, I think that's an inspiring story. But I mean, this is a case where, okay, here's a very extreme group, and here's a gentleman who's black, who's the, you know, the target of their ire, and he was able to infiltrate and just through conversation was able to, you know, get Ku Klux Klan members to leave. So anyways, I was thinking about that, and you know, is there a way that we can bridge the divide between different groups? You know, if they do have somewhat different values, I don't know what the, I don't know what this gentleman talked to them about, but
yeah, then it's amazing.
I haven't dug that deep.
I'm gonna have to look that one up. It's really hard because you need to be part of the group to influence the group. And so, you know, I'm trying to not be political, so I'm trying to think of a group that isn't political. Well, I mean, yeah. You
go ahead. Go ahead. Be political.
Okay. So to convince someone who's a member of MAGA,
the Trump supporters.
Trump supporters, yeah. To convince someone within that group, you can't be a Democrat and then turn around and talk to a group of Trump supporters, because they're not going to listen. They're going to hear it differently. And we know that we actually hear people differently if they're part of our group versus not part of our group. So we hear the positive things they're saying if they're part of our group, and we hear the negative things if they're not part of our group. So two people listening to Trump speak, if they're from different persuasions, then they're going to hear what he's actually saying differently. So you can't change a group's view unless you're actually part of it. And that's obviously what this individual did, which is quite amazing. Actually became part of the group and then started actually talking to them. So, you know, if we want, a men's group to change, we need to get people who are within that men's group to understand that they need to change, and then for them to try and change it. There's no point in a woman speaking to a men's group about you know, how this is discriminatory and all the rest of it. And that's why most of these things, especially from a political point of view, never actually work, because you've got, you know, a white male president trying to, you know, convince people that he's going to solve, the issues in black neighborhoods, or he's going to, you know, solve issues with gender discrimination, or he's going to solve, right? It's never actually going, nobody's actually going to take that seriously, because he's not part of those groups. And so we need to get individuals who are part of those groups to actually then be willing to influence those groups. And I remember I had someone speak to me and say, you know, what right do you have to talk about racism when you're a white male, and you probably haven't experienced racism? And it's like, because it's mainly white males who in Western countries who are racist, right? And so therefore I can actually change that. Yeah, a black woman is not going to be able to affect racism. You need white males willing to stand up and say, we've got to actually stop treating people like this. And so, we need people within the groups actually willing to actually change the groups and willing to actually influence the people within them. Otherwise, they're not going to listen in the same way, and you're not going to get the same effect. But that's hard.
Yeah.
That's really hard.
Yeah, I've thought about that too, just in terms of, you know, sort of the left right political divide. And you know, left, the extreme left or extreme right, they're not going to listen to the other side at all. So you kind of need the moderates in the middle to say, you know, that are kind of on the same side, to be like, whoa, you're going too far here. You need, and then the danger with like social media is like, if you're a moderate and then you say something, you know, you say, hey, we need to like slow down here, you know, this is too extreme, you get labeled as, oh, well, you're the other side now.
Yeah.
You're right or you're left. And so it's another thing where it's like people who are moderating voices, let's say, are not, feel like they can't speak because of this issue with social media, where they'll just be shouted down and told they're actually part of the other side, and they're not, you know, essentially that they're not part of the group.
Yeah.
They're actually in the other group. And you're like, well, I'm not, look at my beliefs, I'm not in that group, you know? So.
Yeah. And I think that's another big problem with the internet at the moment, is the comments section, right? We actually need to get rid of the comments section. These people don't actually have a right to have a say. If a journalist has spent 6 months investigating something and they publish it, that should be it, right? And that should be what we should be read. There shouldn't be a whole comment section based on a whole bunch of people who we don't even know who they are, all of a sudden saying, "Oh, this person just woke," or "this person's doing that." All is not, which it really does devalue all the work that this individual's put in. And we really, I mean, I was disgusted recently. I'm a surf lifesaver, I mentioned earlier. And we actually had a big rescue here a couple of weekends ago. And one of our patrol members, who's amazing, and she's gone all the way through from the junior all the way through, and she's 16. She had to jump out of the rescue boat to swim across and climb onto some rocks and be quite rough conditions to rescue three teenage boys who are 17, 18. She's only 16. And she swam them back to the boat, and it was amazing. I mean, one of them had concussion. He's now, you know, safe and alive because of it. And the media came and they had the choppers and they took all of that. And she got interviewed several times. And then all these comments came up about, you know, oh, why wasn't it a bloke? Or what are you doing sending, you know, a girl in to do this? And she did an amazing job. And then there were started comments about what she looked like and all. And it's just like, why do we have that? That just makes no sense. That's just not necessary. And I think we really need to just delete those comments, right? Why do we have comments nowadays? Where did this come from, and why do we have it? I don't understand why. And it's this idea that everyone deserves to have a say, and I don't think everyone does deserve to have a say, because most people, what they have to say isn't very nice and isn't appropriate. So let's get rid of the comment section.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm going to be controversial and just say, let's get rid of the comment section.
Well, and not only that, but, you know, back to what we were talking about with journalism, it's also just being, you know, ignorant of the facts and, you know, coming with, you know, so like everyone wants their say, but they're not willing to actually dive in and find out what's actually, you know, I mean, if you come with data, if you come with facts,
yeah.
I mean, So I think there's value in that, but most people don't. You know, they just have their own opinion, or they just, you know, I read some article and I'm going to hold that as the truth, you know.
Yeah. And if you do have data and you do have facts, then write your own article.
Yeah. Well, fair point. Yeah.
It's like, put too much time work. And effort in and write your own article. And if you couldn't be bothered doing that, then you don't have a right to comment. So
yeah.
We can still get rid of the comments.
It's too much work.
Yeah.
Too much work. It's much easier, you know, 3 a.m. to just fire off your opinion on something you know nothing about.
Yeah.
Anyways, we should probably wrap it up, but if people would like to comment on this episode, go right ahead and tell Mark what you really think of him.
No, tell me, kidding. Go for it. Go for it.
Anyways, Mark, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Enjoyed your book. I learned a lot. If people want to get the book, where can they find it? And where can they find you online if they want to interact with you?
So it's an American publisher. So any good bookstore should be able to get a hold of it for you. Or all the online bookstores have it available. Go to wherever. And if you want to check me out or sign up to my newsletter, it's just at www.markwilliams.com. So markwilliams.com. Nice. Okay, and cool. Easy.
And I saw you had a free download for people who are dealing with video game addiction, is it?
It's just with addiction. So just any devices, issues. It's mainly with device smartphones. So there's one there for kids, there's one for teens, and there's one for adults that you can download. One download, that's for free.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right, cool, Mark. Well, thanks again, and I'll be curious to see what your next book's about.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Great talking to you.
Well, that's it for this show, and as always, I hope you learned as much as I did. If you enjoyed this episode, you should definitely check out our previous conversation with investigative journalist Guillaume Petrone on living in the shadow of the dark cloud. That episode is all about how our overuse of digital technology is actually harming the environment, and not just our brains. ScienceCentric is a FlowSpark Media production. Our producer for this episode was Alexander James. Guest booking was handled by Melissa David. Until next time, I'm Eric Olson.